There's the theme music. Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I'm so happy to be welcoming once again, actually for the ninth time on this program, Dr. Dudley Danoff. Hello, Dr. Danoff.
Hi.
It's nice to talk with you again.
Oh, my pleasure. Nine times. Well, time goes fast when we're having fun, huh?
I know. Isn't that the truth? So, your book was originally called Penis Power.
Correct.
And now the new edition is called The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, How to Stay Vital at Any Age. And the website is it theultimateguidetomalesexualhealth.com or is there no D in front?
We left the sex, so it's theultimateguidetomenshealth.com.
Men's health. Yeah, all right.
So you might ask, why did we update the book and leave the word penis
exactly
out of the title?
I was going to ask you.
So the deal is, here we are in the 21st century, and penis is perceived in many minds, and particularly in the general press, as being a pejorative word. And every time I go on television and they introduce me, here comes Dr. Danoff, author of Penis Power, our favorite Beverly Hills urologist, there's a giggle and laughter. And I said, hey, you know, penis is not a pejorative word. It's a body part. The penis to the urologist is what the heart is to the cardiologist, or the stomach to the gastroenterologist. Get over it.
Right? Exactly,
there was so
but
much
people
pushback
can't seem
from
to.
From the mainstream press. That we came out with a new shortened edition, updated, and we felt, let's just leave the word penis out of it so more people will read about the book and in the process get the penis out of the closet.
Yes, and it is such, both books, well, it's they're excellent, and
well,
the famous Larry King gives a blurb on the back cover. Dr. Danoff's book is the best I've ever read on this most important subject. Every man should read it, and so should women. And that seems to be many of the people that give the blurbs say that, including Jerry Mayer, playwright and television writer and producer, a book loaded with wisdom and wit, masterfully written. I recommend this book highly as a happy Dr. Danoff patient. He even admits he's a patient. For over 35 years, he has kept my below-the-belt confidence high and my PSA low. He's very grateful. Let me just mention to the listeners who haven't, of course, you know our previous shows are archived, but let me just say that you are president and founder of the Cedars-Sinai Tower Urology Medical Group in Los Angeles. You're a diplomat of the American Board of Urology and fellow of American College of Surgeons. So you've been in this field about 40 years, right, Dr. Danoff?
Yes, and as we started the program, time goes fast when you're having fun.
Right. And I've been in my business as a sex therapist, a marriage and family therapist, for about 34 years. And at this point in time, God willing, I keep my marbles, and I think that's likely.
Go.
I don't plan to retire either. It's just such deeply satisfying work. And I suspect that that is true for you, too.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it if I wasn't having fun.
Exactly. I think, you know, we don't want to do anything if it's not satisfying and it's not fun. So there's been more and more information out there that there is a connection. It even has an acronym, PIED. Porn-induced erectile dysfunction. And I want to talk with you about this because it seems to be an increasingly difficult problem, especially for young men. But I'm wondering if we could just do an overview first, Dr. Danoff, of erections and more satisfying erections, and then we'll get into the porn connections for dysfunction.
Well, let me say, in most men between the ages of 0 and 90 are capable of getting an erection, and most do every night in their sleep when all the psychological factors are gone. But an erection is a complex mechanism. It requires proper circulation. It requires blood staying in the penis. It requires endocrine function, hormonal function, neurologic or nerve function, and above all, and at the center of it, is psychological function. So
yes,
any self-doubt when it comes to an erection is like a self-fulfilling prophecy, or like the dog that chases his tail around in an ever-decreasing circle until he disappears up his you-know-what. So mm-hmm. negativity when it comes to the penis is like a poison dart. When we talk about porn-induced erectile dysfunction, we almost always talk about it in the context of a younger man or even an older man who basically has all the physiologic functions intact. In other words, nothing wrong with the neurology part, nothing wrong with the vascular part, nothing wrong with the anatomic part, but there is something wrong between his ears.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can talk. I mean, I'm sure we will delve into why this is the case,
mm-hmm.
but that is universally the case.
Yes, yes. But just before we go into the porn connections, and there are many, I think it would be useful just to let our listeners know that more satisfying erections can occur when a man is leading a healthy lifestyle, when he's managing his stressors, when he can reestablish intimacy. And that means actually talking. Many men withdraw into a cocoon of silence, and sometimes even punctuated by angry outbursts. Can we just talk a moment about especially that point of reestablishing intimacy, which is so important for men of any age who want to have good erections?
Well, I mean, for me and for probably you and people in your field and certainly knowledgeable people in my field, the greatest aphrodisiac is love itself. You know, it's not Cialis or Viagra or your erection, you know, lasting more than 4 hours and then call everybody you know to brag about it, but or some whiffle dust, you know, from a rhinoceros horn from deepest, darkest Africa. But the greatest aphrodisiac is love. And the way that comes about is by communicating. So if you have a partner that's doing something that is untasteful or unsatisfactory, you've got to communicate that to your partner, just as your partner must communicate to you, you know, what makes them feel good, what pushes their red button. So that's, you know, that's a very essential part of it. And one of the problems, you know, with viewing endless porn, and why now? Because porn is available everywhere, on every handheld device, in every corner of the earth, in every crevice of every building. I mean, it's endless.
Yes.
It's mind-numbing.
It's startling how easily it is available, and some studies show that boys as young as 10, 11, 12 are having access to streaming porn.
Well, I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, you know, my 12-year-old nephew is more conversant with the Internet and a handheld device than I am and can Google and Yahoo some obscure fact. So certainly, you know, they're capable. of downloading or viewing pornographic material, much to the chagrin of their parents.
Yes, yes.
So that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yes. So I looked up some statistics about this. In 1992, about 5% of men experienced ED at age 40, and this was according to the U.S. National Institutes of Health, NIH. And then a study in the July 2013 Journal of Sexual Medicine found that 26% of adult men seeking help for ED were under 40. So it went from 5% to 26%. And then in a 2014 study of 367 U.S. military personnel, younger men than 40, one-third reported ED. And finally, just to finish up these stats, a 2012 Swiss study found the condition among a third of even younger men, 18 to 25.
Yeah, and I certainly my clinical observation and my clinical practice and my patient demographics would support those facts.
Mm-hmm. So
I think that there are a multitude of reasons, both real and speculative. Certainly, the world has become very more complex. There's infinitely more stress than there used to be on a global basis. There's a lot of self-doubt. There's a lot of comparing to the perfect images on a television screen or on a pornographic screen. Mm-hmm. And all of those things, do I fess up? Is my penis long enough? Am I going to ejaculate too soon? And the moment self-doubt enters the equation, the penis becomes weak, tired, and non-functional.
One of the things I like about your book is that you have very cute, clever, often funny drawings of the penis in various states.
Well, I mean, the way that came about, we talk about the penis personalities.
Yep,
and what we say is a man basically is the same in the bedroom as he is in the boardroom. If we say he's pompous in the bedroom, then he's pompous in the boardroom. If he's a loudmouth in the boardroom, he's probably a loudmouth in the bedroom. And then we kind of put them into positive and negative ones, and we use the P word. We have, the passionate penis personality, the Red Butler, the Prince Charming. So that would be a positive one. we have the pathetic penis personality, sad, a total downer. That would be a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we made these little funny cartoons. So it's very tongue in cheek, but there's a lot of truth in it. But what is your penis personality? I'm talking to the men in your audience.
Sure. And I remember many years ago, Dr. Ruth Westheimer actually sort of semi-quoting the Talmud said that a message delivered with humor, I'm paraphrasing this now, but a message delivered with humor is a message that is often better retained. Because a lot of people are embarrassed about sex and sexuality, so if you put some humor, and that's what you've done, your book is filled with.
If you've seen more penises than can fill the Rose Bowl over a 30-plus year career, mm-hmm. if you don't have a sense of humor about that, then I feel sorry for you.
Exactly.
And I have heard every single genital joke that was ever invented, because when a man comes in for an examination, he is very, very uncomfortable, and he always tries to soften up the atmosphere. Hey, doc, have you heard this one? Mm-hmm. And I've heard every single one of them, and I usually try to be polite. Have you heard this one yet? Not yet.
Uh-huh.
And the other interesting thing, which I have in the book, is the male organ, the penis, has more monikers, more nicknames, more acronyms than any other body part. I mean, as I list probably 100 of them, you know, wiener, whacker, rod, you know, schlong, whatever you want to call it. And no other body part, not your ear, not your head, not your breast, you know, has that many humorous nicknames.
Yeah. Oh, that's very true.
Yeah.
So we have with erectile dysfunction, some main causes, and then I want to circle back a little bit to pornography. So we've got diabetes, we've got obesity, we've got social anxiety or depression, and all of these can in addition to drug or alcohol abuse, all of these can contribute to erectile dysfunction. But I have read that urologists aren't willing to rule out that pornography could be partly to blame. And I'm going to now quote a urologist. I don't know if you know him, Dr. A.J. Mangia, former president of the Society for Male Reproduction and Urology. He says, I'm quoting him.
Do you know him? I don't know him personally, but I certainly know of him. He's a credible physician.
Yes, good. So I'm quoting him now. I think it's possible. There's a kind of desensitization of these men, and they only reach the point of feeling stimulated when sex is like it is on a movie.
Well, I think that there's a lot of truth in that, and I think certainly that could be a big part of it. I think that, you know, if a young man or a middle-aged man is watching porno 3 or 4 or 5 times a day, and many of them are masturbating while doing so, I mean, they're just exhausting themselves. I also think that if you look at most pornos, the lighting, the angle of the photograph, the magnification, the turning turning the tape backward and then re-editing it, these are unrealistic or set unrealistic expectations in most men. They look down, they see an ordinary penis, a little fat belly. You know, they may be having sex with a, sort of an ordinary person, an average person, not some, you know, babe with a perfect body and giant breasts. And all of those factors boiled together are a perfect recipe for erectile dysfunction.
Yes, and it also worries a lot of women who may discover their partners watching porn, and they say, "Well, I don't even begin to look like this porn star."
Right.
So then they often
let alone do what the overwhelming majority of porn stars are purported to do or pictured to do. You got to be some sort of a freak of nature or a very strange bedfellow, you know, to do some of those things. I mean, they're outrageous. They're beyond the pale.
And it gives some misleading messages that, you know, every woman just can't wait to spread her legs.
That has not been my personal experience.
That's right.
I mean, it's every man's dream, but it certainly doesn't have any connection to reality. I mean, you know, to have a meaningful relationship, as we've talked about so many times, Deanna.
Yes.
I mean, it's between two consenting adults. I mean, whether it be male, female, gay, bi, you know, whatever it is, it's got to be a loving relationship. I mean, sexual intercourse is not a circus act. It's not a performance. If it perceived that way, it has no soul. It's without meaning. And you keep looking at that stuff long enough, and you lose your soul. You lose your enthusiasm. You lose the feeling of passion. You lose the feeling of love. I mean, it's a total disaster when it comes to erectile dysfunction.
Well, yes, and especially with, like, a teenage brain is still forming. It's more plastic.
Yeah. Is this the norm? Is this what's to be expected? Is this what I want my mate, how mm-hmm. I want my mate to act? Mm-hmm. It really is mind distorting. And, you know, the younger your mind, the easier it is to be distorted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so we also have some other sort of misleading messages of porn. I mentioned every woman can't wait to spread her legs. And another is that women love to flaunt their bodies. In reality, few women are exhibitionists, but sometimes a man who's watched a lot of porn thinks his real-life female partner is just going to be fine about walking around naked and posing and bending over and so on. And that for lots of women who aren't so confident, that's not going to happen.
Well, I mean, look, if a woman has an absolute perfect body, you know, with zero body fat and enormous breasts, I mean, if I were that woman, I'd be very proud to walk around naked and bend over all day long. But the reality is, you know, virtually very, 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 very few women look that way. And
yeah.
most women are modest. Most women have, a wrinkle or a crease or a dimple where they don't want it, and they are very modest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's probably part of the reason that we like candlelight dinners and we like, you know, low lighting in the bedroom when we're making love, so we can erase or film over or screen out the imperfections. And another important, very important factor, not only about this image of women, but how about the inadequate feeling a man will get when he thinks, after watching porn, you know, that an erection is supposed to last, you know, all night long and all day long and is pounding away like a jackhammer? I mean, that's just not the way it is.
Not the way it is, and that combined with the penis size that we see in lots of porn films. I mean, these guys are hired for having above average size cocks.
I would certainly agree. And, you know, again, going back to the number of penises that I have seen, you know, it really is a bell-shaped curve, which is our famous scientific curve, which you have men way on the left that have, below average size, and men way on the right who have above average size. And then, you know, most of the men are sort of in the middle, the overwhelming majority. I mean, the vast majority of men are neither too large nor too small. They're just kind of average. So obviously the porn stars are picked from, the few people on the right end that have, or the right end of the graph that have these enormous penises, sort of like, you know, going into a high school or a college class and then looking around for, you know, the 7-footers to be on your basketball team. You know, they're there,
right.
but they're as rare as hen's teeth. And it's the same in the porno industry.
Yes, and of course, now my understanding is that the actors the male actors regularly take Viagra.
Oh, they have to. Not only do, and we have many of them in our practice. Not only do they.
Oh, do you? That's interesting.
Yeah. Not only do they take Viagra or Cialis or Levitra, but they use injection therapy, which is an even more potent vasodilator. Means so they inject the prostaglandin E1 and papaverine directly into the corpora. That dilates the vessel and gets even more of a blood flow to create a longer erection, which is completely unnatural and not without danger. And then the third thing they do is,
what's the danger, though? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sludging of the blood, and you can get something called priapism,
yes,
which is an erection that lasts longer than 4 hours,
mm-hmm.
and the blood in the penis clots. And then what that does, it destroys these delicate little interstices, which keep the blood from flowing out of the penis for a normal erection. So priapism in and of itself can cause severe and permanent erectile dysfunction.
Permanent.
And then the other factor is, you know, the photographic trick. The photographic trick of running the tape kind of backwards. So the actor will start. He will ejaculate almost as a normal male. Then they stop the film. They wait for him to sort of get his refractory period and erection again. They start it from the beginning. So his ability to go without ejaculating is much prolonged. And then they add the beginning of the film onto the end of the film. So, you know, so it gives
editing.
The impression, how's this guy doing it? My God, he's going off for 20 minutes. Who could do such a thing?
It makes a lot of men, well, their expectations are different. And but then let's go back to the brain, because as I understand it, the more that a man watches pornography, the more, and especially if he's a chronic user, the more the reward centers of the brain lose their capacity for arousal.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, you know, 100%.
Yes.
It's poetically, you would say familiarity breeds contempt. So, look at the same act over and over and over and over, it becomes contemptuous. And that's, you know, that's a negative feedback mechanism, and the brain stops being stimulated. Or it takes more and more and more and more. It's almost an addiction. I mean, with the exception that there's no pain on withdrawal. It's just you have to come down and get your life reorganized.
You know, there is some young men who have experienced erectile dysfunction, and they now have communities. And one website that I think is quite good is yourbrainonporn.com, yourbrainonporn.com. And there are some good TED Talks on that site, too, and talking about the habituation that occurs with lots of guys.
Watching these unfulfillable expectations over and over and over and again. I mean, you have to be Superman to not have negative thoughts. I'm not good enough. My penis isn't big enough. It's not firm enough. I can't perform like that. So it's a negative feedback loop. And since, you know, we talk about it so much in the book that sex in most men is 99% between the ears and 1% between the legs, it's like the bacia morte, the kiss of death.
La bacia morte.
Yeah.
I bet you and your wife have spent some time in Italy.
We have, but I, you know, you forgot to say when you introduced me, I may be president and founder of the Cedar Sinai Medical Center Urology Group, but I also was born in Brooklyn.
So we
know about the bacia morte in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Now, when I went to Princeton and Yale, which I did, they weren't talking much about the bacia morte up there.
Honestly, Dr. Danoff, this is so much a part of your charm. Really, you have this history. You have the down-home kind of real man, and then you have all of this incredible education, Princeton, Yale, and then 40 years of practice, of clinical practice.
And my wife still doesn't trust me. How about that? What am I going to do about the theater? We say after so many years of being married, we have what we call Jewish foreplay.
Yeah, what
20
is that?
Twenty minutes of begging. So that hasn't that hasn't changed much. No, I'm being facetious. If my wife is listening, I do love you, dear. Don't worry about it.
The first time I heard you speak was at a conference, and it was in Monterey. I think it was 2012, and I got to meet your beautiful wife. And she is a singer, and is a native Israeli, isn't she?
Yes, she's a. As she just returned, and I was there for a little while. She was 7 weeks in Israel. She's been in the business since she's a kid, probably over 50 years. They play her records every day on the radio. She just appeared in a national television program, made a few new recordings with young people that are enthusiastic. She looks good. She's like the last man standing, sings great. And so she's had this career that goes on forever, and she's, you know, more enthusiastic, and, you know, you always want a partner who's enthusiastic and loves what they do. So it's been a great ride for me.
Well, and she, I'm sure, would say the same about you. And, you know, when you have a partner who is stimulating and vital, and then you can bring more...
excitement to the
excitement,
table.
Excitement, and then that gives you more dopamine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because dopamine needs some novelty and the hormone of arousal, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And something different and something fresh. You know, I quote a little anecdote in my book.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to share it kind of on the same theme about keeping things fresh and new. And it's a classic experiment in sexuality where you take a female rat or mouse in heat and put it in the cage with a male mouse, and the male mouse will mount the female mouse over and over and with a longer and longer and longer refractory period, that is the period between the time of ejaculation and the ability to ejaculate again or have an orgasm again, until the poor male mouse is lying there in absolute exhaustion. And you take the lady mouse out and you paint her a different mouse color and you spray her with a little new mouse perfume and you put her back in the same cage, and that poor mouse who was, you know, dead on his knees will mount again almost at the same pace as the first time around. And so newness, freshness, excitement, absolutely, that's the way the brain works.
Yes, and I often will counsel my clients that if they want a monogamous relationship, they need to stimulate more dopamine, the hormone of arousal, with novelty by maybe playing out some fantasies, maybe making love in different places. This is one reason, of course, why vacation sex is often hotter, because they don't have the to-do list, and they're making love in new places, and maybe
right,
it would
and
be
more focused, less distracted, more at ease.
Yes.
All of those go into, you know, a satisfying sexual relationship.
Yes, yes. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the desensitization that we've alluded to before, the potential to desensitize you to normal. This is somebody who's watching a lot of porn, and especially the young men who are experiencing ED, to desensitize you to normal, natural things, and ultimately rob you of the one thing that maybe they thought that they might have through watching porn, and that's the ability to experience pleasure. Pleasure. And so some of these guys are so sensitized to watching the woman on the screen, the pixelated figure, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and she doesn't resemble a real-life partner, and the only way they can... So I always ask, if somebody comes in and he's young and saying, you know, I'm experiencing erectile dysfunction, well, first I'll say, have you been to a urologist to get checked out, because that's really important. But then, and the answer is yes, I'll say, can you get an erection when you masturbate, and especially when you masturbate to porn? And the answer is yes. Can you get an erection when you masturbate without porn? And sometimes the answer is no.
Yeah.
That they need that pornography.
The extra stimulation. Well, so, you know, one of the tests of psychological factors and non-psychological factors is every adult male who has his vascular system intact, his neurologic system intact, his endocrine system intact, hormones intact, will get an erection during sleep. It's called a nocturnal erection, and we can actually monitor that. So that's when all of the psychological factors are gone. Clearly, if a young man is, you know, watching porn and masturbating seven times in a day, I mean, he could have trouble getting an erection at night. I mean, he's literally exhausted himself, and he needs a longer and longer refractory period. So sometimes the lines become very blurred, but there's no question that psychologically excess porn is a killer. Physically, excess porn is a killer. Now, on the other hand, I think it's fair to say sometimes a little porn or a moderate amount of porn or selective porn or tasteful porn, I mean, maybe that's a non sequitur since it's hard to think of any porn that's tasteful, but sometimes that could be stimulating to a relationship. So in all fairness to porn, I mean, it's not 100% bad, maybe 97% harmful, but you know, there is some, socially justifiable reason for porn to be. I don't know if that's fair or not, and
I think you
would agree with me.
I think it's fair. I've worked with couples where she enjoys porn, particularly, now there is some porn it's often produced and made by women. My late friend, I'm so sorry she's died of ovarian cancer, but Candida Royale was the first woman on the scene starting in 1984 to make erotic films for couples to watch where there's a plot,
right,
where the couples like each other, they're in a relationship, the lighting is good, and it's still explicit.
Right.
Now, Erica Lust is a filmmaker out of Barcelona, Spain, and she makes some very nice films with good lighting and some of that too, where
the storyline,
and because you know, to use the vernacular, women will look at some male porn. Well, how come this couple is fucking? Well, they're not even connected,
right?
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No, I mean it's most porn, you know, that we see on the internet and which most young people are exposed to in endless quantities is without a soul. It has no soul. So I'm not familiar with those people that you just named, but I certainly can be very sympathetic, and I really think there is a place for that. So I'm really glad you mentioned that for your listeners, Deanna.
Yes, yes. And if the woman, there are some women who will watch with their partners, and then once the secrecy has been taken away, like the man who watches in secret, that's often deleterious for the marriage or for the relationship. But when it's out in the open, and then they might even see certain things portrayed on the screen that they might like to try. And I will give porn its due in terms of oral sex. Over the years, oral sex has become more common. I'm talking over 25 years, maybe longer, more common because we see it in explicit films. And a lot of guys are very nervous about performing cunnilingus, and they can actually watch and get some visual education from watching a man on the screen perform oral sex.
Well, I'm going to defer to your area of expertise on that. I'm going to stick to the urologic part, but I certainly can understand how that works, and I can understand why it is probably more widely accepted. We certainly talk about that a little bit in the book. But again, I'm you know, addressing more male sexuality in my point of view, you know, based on my, you know, my training and my experience. So
of course,
I consider myself a great student of female sexuality, and even after 40 years of marriage, I still consider myself quite a beginner, and I'm trying to learn something new every day.
Well, I can tell you, and me too, you know, with my gerontologist hat on, I will say that one thing that keeps, that helps us with successful aging is that we remain curious and we want to learn. We want to learn all we can learn. And I wanted to just circle back a little bit and that really, I have experienced this clinically, that a woman can live with a partner's porn use as long as she sees that it's not a mark against her. In other words, her partner is not comparing her to maybe the silicone-enhanced babe that's on the screen with big boobs and, not as you put it earlier, not a wrinkle. And it's not a mark against her Yeah.
Well, I would say that means the way you would put it and the way I would put it as a urologist is we cannot lose sight of reality. You know, what is real? What is illusion? What is make-believe? What is fake? And the second thing that in the same category, you've got to do something which is age-appropriate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a 70-year-old guy watching, you know, two teenagers go out in a porn film cannot think by any stretch of the imagination that he could duplicate what he sees. So he has to be realistic. He has to be age appropriate. So I think those are two more factors that are very important.
Age appropriate. And I want to just make a comment about the older woman. Let's hear it for the older woman because she can bring more to the bed. She can bring experience and empathy and understanding, and especially understanding of her own sexuality and the reality that her pleasure is not exclusively dependent on penile penetration.
I think it's, you know, it's a point well taken, you know, and if, from a man's point of view, I can tell you that equal pleasure can be obtained, you know, from occasional prolonged intercourse with one orgasm as with frequent rapid intercourse with multiple orgasms. So that's just a fact which is out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I heard on one of the NPR stations an interview with, this is shifting a little bit, but it is in the realm of female sexuality. So a woman named Peggy Ornstein has written a book called Girls and Sex. And this is this year, 2016. And so with porn is actually, she claims, changing a generation of girls. And there is sort of an eroticizing of the degradation of women. See, a lot of guys will watch porn and they need to keep upping it for more novelty, right? So some of the porn gets kind of aggressive and maybe even violent. And in a study of behaviors in popular porn, nearly 90% of the 304 random scenes contained physical aggression toward women, who nearly always responded either neutrally or with pleasure. And the more serious sort of implication is that even if what kids are watching is utterly vanilla, these girls are learning that women's sexuality exists for the benefit of men. They don't learn about their own pleasure. And I find that just appalling because there can be so much pleasure in sexuality. So the porn business is really deleterious for men and for women.
I mean, I think that point is certainly well taken based on, you know, my clinical experience. Yeah, I think sexuality is becoming very distorted. The act of sexuality is becoming a circus event. You know, who can jump higher, who can run faster? I mean, when we watch the Olympics, I mean, having sex is not an Olympic sport. You know, you don't get a medal for quickness or height or swiftness or you know, form. It should be a passionate act between two caring people. I mean, we've all seen, I don't go to the clubs anymore, but I have, you know, teenage people that are related to me, and they tell me about the scenes in the clubs. I mean, it's the exotic outfits, and, you know, up here where I, close to where I live, we have West Hollywood and Hollywood, and I drive home sometime on a Saturday night after going out to dinner, and I mean, the girls that are lined up to go into the clubs and the costumes and the dresses and scantily dressed, oh my goodness gracious me, it's mind-boggling. So yeah, I think a lot has changed, and I'm not sure it's for the better.
I'm not sure it is either. You know, that
let's make America great again. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Of course, I really don't like what Trump says about that. But
no, I'm just,
because
I'm
think being, America
being,
is
I'm
great.
Being, I'm being facetious.
I know you are. I know you are. And, but
he's one of my favorites, of course.
Yes. Yes.
Not.
Yeah, right. I know. This is an election like we've never had, right?
Oh, man, I'm telling you, it's just incredible. I just, you know, maybe it's the lesser of the two evils, but one candidate is so incredibly unfit for office that it's just, and we talk about this, the doctors, you know, we sit around at some of the older doctors at noontime, and we talk about politics and pretty women and the days of yore.
In the days of yore, yes.
I mean, and even, you know, a lot of my doctor friends who are basically right-wing Republicans, very conservative, I would find it almost impossible to vote for a Democrat, you know, say that they don't know what they're going to do because the Republican candidate is a lunatic. He's a maniac. He's a dysfunctional human being, self-centered beyond. I mean, he's not a normal person.
No, and he is
scary.
It's scary, and it really
Nietzsche
defines narcissism
way. Called it Nietzscheism, as in Nietzsche. Me. Now enough about me. Tell me what you think of me. You know
yeah, exactly.
Song.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we're off the subject. Yeah,
that's all right. We can get off the subject, you and I, after all these years of having on-the-air chats. And I have to tell you, Dr. Danoff, I am so complimented that you want to return to this program. You have so much to offer, and I have many clients, and I hope you have patients, too, that will listen to the archived versions and learn.
Well, that would be very nice, and I keep coming on because I find you to be extremely interesting. I find you to be very provocative, and definitely something that I don't hear in my practice, and I do. My God, this year I've done maybe 100 radio interviews, and you have a very, very unique perspective, and you express yourself very well, and you're very candid, and for me, that's very refreshing.
Well, thank you. Well, I find you refreshing too because you are so.
Well, what are you doing Tuesday night for dinner, Noah?
Well, I'm up here in Seattle, and fortunately, you know, I've got Brian, who is still my fiance.
I met Brian. Handsome devil, that Brian. Lucky man.
Well, he's a lucky man, and I'm a lucky woman, because he's approaching the age of 70, and he has zero dysfunction. Zero.
Great.
But he's
just
healthy, and
lifestyle,
also,
exercise, diet, cardiovascular fitness, good mental health, positive attitude. I mean, those are the things that make it go. And anybody that says something to the contrary is just flat out wrong.
Actually, that is so true. Yeah, the lifestyle, and just to give a little encouragement for people who might be listening, if there's still problems, sexual problems, and you've been to somebody like yourself, a urologist, a medical person, they might try sex therapy, you know, because I've seen a lot of people over the years, thousands and thousands, just as you have, and sex therapy can actually work, especially if people are quite motivated. And actually, there have been some studies that show that sex therapy helps revive lost or faltering erections. Now we're back to ED erections in about 70% of the cases. 70%.
Yeah, look, it's a good. We call it penis power. Penis power is the power of positive thinking as applied to your penis. And if your thinking is negative, I think counseling can often put you back on track. So going back to the 1% between your legs and 99% between your ears, I think counseling is a very, very, very important part of ED therapy, particularly if the patient comes to a physician and the physician says, hey, you know, everything is okay. Your testosterone is okay. Your blood pressure is okay. You don't have diabetes. Your hypertension is under control. You don't have hyperlipidemia. You don't have coronary artery disease. Now it's between your ears. You need to get the power of positive thinking in the right place. So for me, the psychological part, the counseling part, is a very, very important aspect of treating ED.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Because it can reduce anxiety around sex, and it can correct destructive erection myths. Because a lot of men have these erection myths, so you know that.
Oh boy, do I ever!
And you address them in your book.
I do indeed.
And then we can also help. You can help. I can help assess stressors, working to minimize the stressors.
Yeah, the concept there, just, I mean, in a word, I call it compartmentalization. So mm-hmm. If you have stress in the office, you have road rage on the way home on the freeway, and you fought with your landlord on the way up to your apartment, you got to put all of that in a little box you have outside the door.
Yes, I'm sitting here in Seattle with my windows open, and there was a big roaring, maybe motorcycle, so I missed a little bit of what you just said.
I said it. You put it in the word, the concept of compartmentalization.
I heard that, and that's right. And men tend to be better at that than women.
You got to put it in a box, leave it outside the door when you come home.
That's the part I didn't hear, and that's so true.
Yeah.
Because
it's an oversimplification, but it's but it's an outstandingly valid concept.
And I also help my couples learn how to work out relationship issues and improve their sexual negotiation skills, because the truth is, A lot of couples really don't know about their sexual desires. They haven't had that discussion. Couples almost never discuss, before they come to see me, their sexual desires, and both sexual appetites and sexual interests tend to be highly divergent between heterosexual partners, especially heterosexual partners, and they need to talk about it. And of course, just to circle back to pornography again, what makes it appealing to some men is that the women always enjoy sex. And the tragedy is that a woman may not even know that she's not meeting her partner's needs because he's not telling her what they are. She doesn't know. She's in the dark.
Communication. Going back
communication.
To communication.
We're back to that.
There you go.
And you talk a lot about that in your book, too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's certainly the key to a relationship. You tell me what you like, and I'll tell you what I like, and, you know, let's negotiate. Let's negotiate the differences. So I'll give you a little of what you want. You give me a little of what I want, and then we're right back on track.
Yeah, and when you think about it, Dr. D, so much of life is about negotiation, isn't it? We negotiate things.
Yeah, and compromise, you know. If you think you can go get up in the morning and not compromise, you're never going to make it. So I say to my patients, I say it to my kids, I say it to my wife. I said, I get up in the morning and I say, okay, I'm going to compromise today. The only decision I have to make is how much do I compromise and in what areas. But to think I'm not going to compromise in my day's activities, interacting with my wife, with my patients, with my partners, with my golf buddies, is ridiculous. You can't go through life without compromising. I mean, a few people try, and, you know, they're just miserable and antisocial and unsuccessful. Those of us who are pliable and willing to compromise are the most successful in every aspect of life, whether it be sexuality, business, interpersonal relationships. I mean, I have a very strong feeling about that.
And you express it well, and I totally agree, you know. Communication. The joke is, what's the four-letter word that if couples did it more, would be so much happier? And no, it is not F-U-C-K, it's T-A-L-K.
Yeah, I saw that one coming. I never heard it before, but I certainly saw it coming. I indeed did.
So my hope is that I can entice you back to this program for a 10th time, maybe in a few months.
Well, we certainly can try. If my schedule permits and I'm available, I would enjoy spending another hour with you, Deanna, and it's always a pleasure.
Thank you. I feel the same way so much that, you know, I think you bring so much to this program, so much knowledge, and I encourage people to get your book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, How to Stay Vital at Any Age. There are practical, safe, no-nonsense advice for men and women. There are facts about erectile dysfunction, potency, and the prostate, and tips for a healthy, active sex life at any age. It's really a book that is worth reading carefully for men and for women, and maybe even reading it together and then using some of what you write about as a springboard for discussion.
You know, I even have a special chapter in the book dedicated specifically to women. I mean, I want a woman to be a penis professor. I want to know everything about the penis in her life, how it works, where it works, when it works, why it works. So I encourage women to read the book. It's not demeaning in any way. They are my equal. They are and should be the equal of every man in any relationship. I'm talking about a heterosexual relationship. My book also applies to gay couples. I mean, the same emotions, the same caring, the same principles apply in a gay relationship as a straight relationship, old, young, middle-aged. It's all, at the end of the day, the same.
Absolutely, and I'm going to let you have the final word. It's a very good word. The music came on. We need to end the show. Thank you so much, Dr. Dudley Danoff. Thank
pleasure
you. Bye-bye,
pleasure.
Everybody.
Pleasure.